Chapter 20. The mere love of adventure is no saving grace. It is no grace at all. It lays a man under no obligation of faithfulness to an idea, and even to his own self. Roughly speaking, an adventurer may be expected to have courage, or at any rate, may be said to need it. But courage in itself is not an ideal. A successful highwayman showed courage of a sort, and pirate crews have been known to fight with courage, or perhaps only with reckless desperation in the manner of cornered rats. There is nothing in the world to prevent a mere lover or pursuer of adventure from running at any moment. There is his own self, his mere taste for excitement, the prospect of some sort of gain, but there is no sort of loyalty to bind him in honor to consistent conduct. I have noticed that the majority of mere lovers of adventure are mightily careful of their skins, and the proof of it is that so many of them manage to keep it whole to an advanced age. You find them in mysterious nooks of islands and continents, mostly red-nosed and watery-eyed, and not even amusingly boastful. There is nothing more futile under the sun than a mere adventurer. He might have loved at one time which would have been a saving grace. I mean loved adventure for itself. But if so, he was bound to lose this grace very soon. Adventure by itself is but a phantom, a dubious shape without a heart. Yes, there is nothing more futile than an adventurer. But nobody can say that the adventurous activities of the British race are stamped with the futility of a chase after mere emotions. The successive generations that went out to sea from these isles went out to toil desperately in adventurous conditions. A man is a worker. If he is not, that he is nothing. Just nothing like a mere adventurer. Those men understood the nature of their work, but more or less dimly, in various degrees of imperfection. The best and greatest of their leaders even had never seen it clearly, because of its magnitude and the remoteness of its end. This is the common fate of mankind, whose most positive achievements are born from dreams and visions followed loyally to an unknown destination. And it doesn't matter. For the great mass of mankind, the only saving grace that is needed is steady fidelity to what is nearest to hand, and heart in the short moment of each human effort. In other and in greater words, what is needed is a sense of immediate duty, and a feeling of impalpable constraint. Indeed, seamen and duty are all the time inseparable companions. It has been suggested to me that this sense of duty is not a patriotic sense or a religious sense, or even a social sense in a seaman. I don't know. It seems to me that a seaman's duty may be an unconscious compound of these three, something perhaps smaller than either, but something much more definite for the simple mind, and more adapted to the humbleness of the seaman's task. It has been suggested also to me that the impalpable constraint is put upon the nature of a seaman by the spirit of the sea, which he serves with a dumb and dogged devotion. Those are fine words conveying a fine idea. But this I do know, that it is very difficult to display a dogged devotion to a mere spirit, however great. In everyday life, ordinary men require something much more material, effective, definite and symbolic on which to concentrate their love and their devotion. And then, what is it, this spirit of the sea? It is too great, and too elusive to be embraced, and taken to a human breast. All that a guileless, or guileful seaman knows of it is its hostility, its exaction of toil as endless as its ever-renewed horizons. No. What awakens the seaman's sense of duty, what lays that impalpable constraint upon the strength of his manliness, what commands his not always dumb, if always dogged devotion, is not the spirit of the sea, but something that in his eyes has a body, a character, a fascination, and almost a soul. It is his ship. There is not a day that has passed for many centuries now without the sun seeing scattered over all the seas groups of British men whose material and moral existence is conditioned by their loyalty to each other, and their faithful devotion to a ship. Each age has sent its contingent, not of sons, for the great mass of seamen have always been a childless lot, but of loyal and obscure successors taking up the modest, but spiritual inheritance of a hard life and simple duties, of duties so simple, that nothing ever could shake the traditional attitude born from the physical conditions of the service. It was always the ship, bound on any possible errand in the service of the nation, that has been the stage for the exercise of seamen's primitive virtues. The dimness of great distances and the obscurity of lives protected them from the nation's admiring gaze. Those scattered distant ships' companies seemed to the eyes of the earth only 1 degree removed on the right side, I suppose, from the other strange monsters of the deep. If spoken of at all, they were spoken of in tones of half-contemptuous indulgence. A good many years ago it was my lot to write about one of those ships' companies on a certain sea, under certain circumstances, in a book of no particular length. That small group of men whom I tried to limb with loving care, but sparing none of their weaknesses, was characterized by a friendly reviewer as a lot of engaging ruffians. This gave me some food for thought. Was it, then, in that guise, that they appeared through the mists of the sea, distant, perplexed, and simple-minded? And what on earth is an engaging ruffian? He must be a creature of literary imagination, I thought, for the two words don't match in my personal experience. It has happened to me to meet a few ruffians here and there, but I never found one of them engaging. I consoled myself, however, by the reflection that the friendly reviewer must have been talking like a parrot, which so often seems to understand what it says. Yes, in the mists of the sea, and in their remoteness from the rest of the race, the shapes of those men appeared distorted, uncouth and faint, so faint as to be almost invisible. It needed the lurid light of the engines of war to bring them out into full view, very simple, without worldly graces, organized now into a body of workers by the genius of one of themselves, who gave them a place and a voice in the social scheme, but in the main still apart in their homeless, childless generations, scattered in loyal groups over all the seas, giving faithful care to their ships and serving the nation, which, since they are seamen, can give them no reward, but the supreme eldon. Tradition 1918, work is the law. Like iron that lying idle degenerates into a mass of useless rust, like water that in an unruffled pool sickens into a stagnant and corrupt state, so without action the spirit of men turns to a dead thing, loses its force, ceases prompting us to leave some trace of ourselves on this earth. The sense of the above lines does not belong to me. It may be found in the notebooks of one of the greatest artists that ever lived, Leonardo da Vinci. It has a simplicity and a truth which no amount of subtle comment can destroy. The master who had meditated so deeply on the rebirth of arts and sciences, on the inward beauty of all things, ships' lines, women's faces and on the visible aspects of nature was profoundly right in his pronouncement on the work that is done on the earth. From the hard work of men are born the sympathetic consciousness of a common destiny, the fidelity to right practice which makes great craftsmen, the sense of right conduct which we may call honor, the devotion to our calling, and the idealism which is not a misty, winged angel without eyes, but a divine figure of terrestrial aspect with a clear glance, and with its feet resting firmly on the earth on which it was born. And work will overcome all evil, except ignorance, which is the condition of humanity, and, like the ambient air, fills the space between the various sorts and conditions of men, which breeds hatred, fear, and contempt between the masses of mankind, and puts on men's lips, on their innocent lips, words that are thoughtless and vain. Thoughtless, for instance, were the words that, in all innocence, I believe, came on the lips of a prominent statesman making in the House of Commons an eulogistic reference to the British merchant service. In this name I include men of diverse status and origin, who live on and by the sea, by it exclusively, outside all professional pretensions and social formulas, men for whom not only their daily bread, but their collective character, their personal achievement and their individual merit come from the sea. Those words of the statesman were meant kindly, but after all, this is not a complete excuse. Rightly or wrongly, we expect from a man of national importance a larger, and at the same time a more scrupulous precision of speech, for it is possible that it may go echoing down the ages. His words were, "It is right when thinking of the Navy, not to forget the men of the merchant service, who have shown, and it is more surprising, because they have had no traditions towards it courage as great, etc., comma, etc." And then he went on talking of the execution of Captain Friot, an event of undying memory, but less connected with the permanent, unchangeable conditions of sea service than with the wrong view German minds delight in taking of Englishman's psychology. "The enemy," he said, "meant by this atrocity, to frighten our sailors away from the sea. What has happened?" he goes on to ask. "Ever at any time in peace have sailors stayed so short a time ashore shown such a readiness to step again into a ship?" Which means, in other words, that they answered to the call. I should like to know at what time of history the English merchant service, the great body of merchant seamen, had failed to answer the call. Noticed or unnoticed, ignored, or commanded, they have answered invariably the call to do their work, the very conditions of which made them what they are. They have always served the nation's needs through their own invariable fidelity to the demands of their special life. But with the development and complexity of material civilization they grew less prominent to the nation's eye among all the vast schemes of national industry. Never was the need greater, and the call to the services more urgent than today. And those inconspicuous workers on whose qualities depends so much of the national welfare, have answered it without dismay, facing risk without glory, in the perfect faithfulness to that tradition which the speech of the statesman denies to them at the very moment when he thinks fit to praise their courage. And mention his surprise. The hour of opportunity has struck not for the first time for the merchant service, and if I associate myself with all my heart in the admiration and the praise which is the greatest reward of brave men, I must be excused from joining in any sentiment of surprise. It is perhaps because I have not been born to the inheritance of that tradition, which has yet fashioned the fundamental part of my character in my young days, that I am so consciously aware of it, and venture to vindicate its existence in this outspoken manner. Merchant seamen have always been what they are now, from their earliest days, before the Royal Navy had been fashioned out of the material they furnished for the hands of kings and statesmen. Their work has made them, as work undertaken with single-minded devotion makes men, giving to their achievements that vitality and continuity in which their souls are expressed, tempered and matured through the succeeding generations. In its simplest definition, the work of merchant seamen has been to take ships entrusted to their care from port to port across the seas, and, from the highest to the lowest, to watch and labor with devotion for the safety of the property and the lives committed to their skill and fortitude through the hazards of innumerable voyages. That was always the clear task, the single aim, the simple ideal, the only problem for an unselfish solution. The terms of it have changed with the years, its risks have worn different aspects from time to time. There are no longer any unexplored seas. Human ingenuity has devised better means to meet the dangers of natural forces. But it is always the same problem. The youngsters who were growing up at sea at the end of my service are commanding ships now. At least I have heard of some of them who do. And whatever the shape and power of their ships, the character of the duty remains the same. A minor torpedo that strikes your ship is not so very different from a sharp, uncharted rock tearing her life out of her in another way. At a greater cost of vital energy, under the well-nigh intolerable stress of vigilance and resolution, they are doing steadily the work of their professional forefathers in the midst of multiplied dangers. They go to and fro across the oceans on their everlasting task. The same men, the same stout hearts, the same fidelity to an exacting tradition created by simple toilers who in their time knew how to live and die at sea. Allowed to share in this work and in this tradition for something like 20 years, I am bold enough to think that perhaps I am not altogether unworthy to speak of it. It was the sphere, not only of my activity, but, I may safely say, also of my affections. But after such a close connection, it is very difficult to avoid bringing in one's own personality. Without looking at all of the aspects of the labor problem, I can safely affirm that I have never seen British seamen refuse any risk, any exertion, any effort of spirit or body up to the extremest demands of their calling. Years ago, it seems ages ago, I have seen the crew of a British ship fight the fire in the cargo for a whole sleepless week, and then, with her decks blown up, I have seen them still continue the fight to save the floating shell. And at last I have seen them refuse to be taken off by a vessel standing by, and this only in order to see the last of our ship, at the word, at the simple word, of a man who commanded them, a worthy soul indeed, but of no heroic aspect. I have seen that. I have shared their days in small boats. Hard days. Ages ago. And now let me mention a story of today. I will try to relate it here mainly in the words of the chief engineer of a certain steamship which, after bunkering, left Lerwick, bound for Iceland. The weather was cold, the sea pretty rough, with a stiff head wind. All went well till next day, about 1:30 p.m., then the captain sighted a suspicious object far away to starboard. Speed was increased at once, to close in with the Faroes, and good lookouts were set fore and aft. Nothing further was seen of the suspicious object, but about 3:30, without any warning, the ship was struck amidships by a torpedo which exploded in the bunkers. None of the crew was injured by the explosion, and all hands, without exception, behaved admirably. The chief officer with his watch managed to lower the number 3 boat. Two other boats had been shattered by the explosion, and though another lifeboat was cleared and ready, there was no time to lower it, and some of us jumped, while others were washed overboard. Meantime, the captain had been busy handing lifebelts to the men and cheering them up with words and smiles, with no thought of his own safety. The ship went down in less than 4 minutes. The captain was the last man on board, going down with her, and was sucked under. On coming up, he was caught under an upturned boat to which 5 hands were clinging. The lifeboat, says the chief engineer, which was floating empty in the distance, was cleverly maneuvered to our assistance by the steward, who swam off to her pluckily. Our next endeavor was to release the captain, who was entangled under the boat. As it was impossible to right her, we set to split her side open with the boat hook, because by awful bad luck the head of the axe we had flew off at the first blow and was lost. The rescue took 30 minutes, and the extricated captain was in a pitiable condition, being badly bruised, and having swallowed a lot of salt water. He was unconscious. While at that work, the submarine came to the surface quite close, and made a complete circle round us, the 7 men that we counted on the conning tower laughing at our efforts. There were 18 of us saved. I deeply regret the loss of the chief officer, a fine fellow and a kind shipmate showing splendid promise. The other men lost 1 A, B, 1 greaser, and 2 firemen were quiet, conscientious, good fellows. With no restoratives in the boat, they endeavored to bring the captain round by means of massage. Meantime, the oars were got out in order to reach the Faroes, which were about 30 miles dead to windward. But after about 9 hours hard work, they had to desist, and, putting out a sea anchor, they took shelter under the canvas. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.